This is another episode of Stand Up Comedy, your host and MC, celebrating 40 plus years on the fringe of show business. Stories, interviews, and comedy sets from the famous and not so famous. Here's your host and MC, Scott Edwards.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Stand Up Comedy, your host and MC, and we have a real treat for us today. He was a regular headliner of mine at Laughs Unlimited in the mid-80s, but before that, he was doing television like Norm Crosby's Comedy Shop. He's been seen in a few movies, other TV shows, including Evening at the Improv in the 80s, and then went on to regular TV work and has even written a couple books. I'm so excited to have him on the podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Ellis Levinson. Ellis, it's so great to hear your voice. It's been a while, but it's great to reconnect. How's life treating you, buddy?
You know, it's treating me. I've gotten old.
Haven't we all?
I looked in the mirror one day and I went, oh, shit. You know, so it's like that. But I never expected my senior years to be this good. I mean, it's I've had a lot of struggles in life, especially early on. And right now, this is like the best time of my life. So it's I'm knocking on wood.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's awesome to hear. As I was alluding when I was talking to the audience before you came to work for me at Laughs, you already had a strong career going. You had been on Norm Crosby's Comedy Shop in 1978. You were a working comic by the time you came to me. When did you kind of get started in comedy, and how did that come about?
The way it came about, I thought it was pretty interesting. I was trying to stay out of the draft because I had no desire to go to Vietnam. By the way, since then, since I retired, I've been to Vietnam twice. So I compensated.
It's funny how life comes around. Okay.
Yeah. And I got to tell you, I loved Vietnam. But anyway, I was teaching because that gave me an exemption, you know. And I was always like a funny guy, you know, class clown kind of guy. And my fellow young teachers would say to me, God, you know, you should go into comedy. And I'm thinking, no, you can't go into comedy because only people in show business can go into comedy. I had no idea how it worked. And I did a cross-country trip with a friend of mine in 1970. And everywhere we went, we would meet other people camping and we'd light up a joint. And my friend Ed would say, hey, do that bit about, and everywhere I went, I was making people laugh. So I get back to teaching at the end of the summer, and a guy says to me, you know, I went to this club called the Improvisation, and they have comedians and singers there. You ought to try out. So I said, I don't know. So another teacher friend of mine who knew the business said, if you ever want to audition for a play, you pick up this thing called Backstage, and you go to an audition. Anyway, without dragging this thing out, I go to an audition. I had no headshot. I had no resume. There was a two-hour wait because I wasn't in the union yet. And I said, I got to put together a monologue. So I wrote a comedy bit in my head that became the first comedy hunk that I ever did. I went to the improv. I tried out. Bud Friedman did not call me back. I went to the Gaslight in the Village. I did a set there, and then I tried out again at the Improv, and I didn't hear back for a week, so I was off for another summer traveling in Europe, and I get back, and my mother says to me, a man named Bud Friedman from the Improvisation called, and he wants to talk to you. Next thing I know, I'm on stage at the Improv, and that started my career.
Wow.
It was really strange how it all worked out.
Yeah, that's kind of the backwards way to get in. Most people do, you know, 6 months, a couple years of open mics and smaller clubs. Getting that kind of opportunity at the Improv with Bud Friedman is amazing. Do you remember what year it was?
1971, April.
Wow, that early on. That's incredible, Ellis. Now, here's the big question. Do you remember that first joke or bit?
Yeah, it was a bit, you know what, you can't do this bit now. It was a bit about teaching in the, shall we say, inner city at a high school where it's minority kids. And I did this whole thing about what it's like to teach there. But I'm including what the kids say with Puerto Rican accents, with black accents. A white guy can't do that now, as if it's something offensive about it. And it wasn't a put down. And there were other guys I know who are teachers who also did similar things. We would be called racist today, and there was no malice involved at all.
Wow. Yep. You know, it's so funny. We've talked often about how comedy has changed, but that's a great example of where a totally innocent bit where you were just echoing what you were hearing as a teacher would, in these day and age, would be taken as ethnically irresponsible and rude. I forgot to ask, what grade were you teaching before 1971?
Ninth and 10th. So, I was teaching like a junior, in those days it was junior high school. It wasn't middle school. Ninth grade would normally, have been junior high school, but there were some ninth graders and then the regular 10th graders at Gompers High School in the Bronx.
Wow. Oh, so this is in New York. That's gotta be a tough class to teach. And what's funny about middle school is you have some kids that look like, young boys, and you have others that have mustaches and hair coming out of their ass. I mean, everybody matures differently, and it's my brother-in-law actually teaches, in junior high, and it's challenging at times, but that's fascinating. I didn't know you used to be a teacher, but also I think of all the people I've interviewed, I believe you got into the business before anybody else, and you don't look that old, so congratulations on that. But you must have done well, because by 1978, you were on the Comedy Shop, and then in 81, you're on Evening at the Improv. You were already getting attention and getting some TV work and eventually some movie work at a time when comedy wasn't quite as hot. In other words, in the 70s, it was still, there weren't that many places to work. By 1980, when I opened Laughs Unlimited, it was just starting to take off. And then, of course, by 1984, it was like Starbucks. There was a club in every corner. But it must have been challenging to survive those first 8 or 9 years.
Well, the thing is, the first 5 years I was in, well, the first... Yeah, 5 years. I was still teaching. That's how I paid the bills. Got very few paid gigs in those days. You know, you worked the so-called showcase clubs. They weren't paying in those days. When I started emceeing at the Comic Strip, which became my home club, and of the original clubs, you know, there was the Improv. There was Catch a Rising Star. That came along a couple of years after I started at the Improv. And then eventually the Comic Strip. The Comic Strip became my home club. It's the only one of the three clubs that is still existing, the Comic Strip. And the last of the owners just passed away this last year, Richie Tinkin. And they were great to me. So then I would become an MC. And as an MC, you start getting paid. So I made a little bit of money, just basically cab fare. And I was one of the first to ask for money. Because in those days, if it was winter, you don't want to take two buses to get to this place because it's cold in New York. And I talked to these guys and I said, you know, I'm hearing that people are calling the club saying, is Ellis Levinson performing this weekend? And if people are coming in to see me, don't you think you guys should pay my cab fare? And they said, okay. And so I sort of broke the ice in a way.
Wow. Yeah, that's funny and double entendre. Well, the interesting thing was that this is, but we should explain to the audience, this is in New York. So this was before Bud moved his club out to LA, and those were the hot clubs in the 70s. Some of them went into the 80s, but a lot of the business and yourself shifted out to the LA area, right? When did you come out to the West Coast?
I came out of it initially in 77 just to see how it would go. I did a set for Mitzi. She already got a recommendation from the owners of the Comic Strip in New York. And, I was in, you know, that was easy. And then I became a regular at the Comedy Store and, at the Improv on the West Coast. And meanwhile, back in the East Coast, Bud Friedman's wife, ex-wife had, the Improv there. It's long gone now. And, so I moved out permanently in 78, in January of 78.
I mean, I didn't know all this history on you. You really were part of the initial grab of this art form being taken from something that was entertainment between strippers and jazz bands to a forefront entertainment through these few clubs that you've name dropped. And this is still a few years before comedy really took off. I mean, when I opened Laughs, it was the 12th full-time comedy club in the country. And like I said, you know, 4 to 5 years later, it was really just, you know, we called the 80s the rock and roll of stand-up comedy because it was this huge wave of attention and money and success. But that's right. Incredible. Now, I know that you came to work for me in the early to mid 80s, and you were already a headliner and doing a lot of work. Do you have any memories of working Laughs Unlimited?
First of all, the answer is a big yes. I think I headlined there like 5 times, maybe 6. And I'll tell you, and don't feel bad about this. Towards the end of my comedy career, I really started burning out. I couldn't come up with much new material and stuff. And one time, the last time I worked for you, you said to me, you know, Ellis, you're not really coming in with much new material, and it's hard for me to keep booking you when people have seen the same material before. And I said to you, you know, Scott, you're right, and I completely understand it. And we had sort of a very honest and diplomatic parting of the ways, and I always respected you for that. But I remember the sets I did. There are certain cities where you just tend to do great. I mean, if you're Robin Williams, you did great anywhere you went, you know. But there were certain cities for average comics like me where you just, they love you there. And it was Sacramento, Cleveland. I killed in Cleveland. the Comic Strip was my home club in New York. Anytime I went there, they gave me the primo spot. And the other one that I always think of is Amarillo, Texas.
Wow.
Believe it or not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure some people
in the panhandle of Texas.
Yeah, and I'm sure some people in LA and in New York would find it surprising that even Sacramento was on that list. But I was trained to operate the room by other comics. So it has been mentioned a few times that working Laughs Unlimited was a little more comfortable and a little more fun than your average road gig. And we also had really good audiences, which I'm sure was one of the reasons you enjoyed performing at my club. There was always a good response. And I don't remember the diplomatic conversation, but I think it's important for the audience, my audience, to hear that one of the things that I think made me a success was that I was always upfront and honest with the entertainment to support them or to make important decisions and stuff. And it sounds like in that 85, 86 range, you were already starting to change direction. For example, I know you were on the TV show Misfits of Science around 1985, and you were doing a few movies. That's kind of exciting. How did you shift to TV and movies from the stage?
Well, I was always an actor. In 1973, which was my greatest year of acting, I was always going to auditions in New York. And there was an audition for, by the way, I don't know if you remember, I used to do a Woody Allen impression.
Oh, yeah.
And when I did it, when I started doing it, nobody else did Woody Allen. I was the only guy. And I'm honestly going to say I don't think anybody's come close since. But they were casting a dinner theater version of Play It Again, Sam. So I went in, I auditioned for it, and I got the job. But also, there's an Elizabethan dinner theater. There was in upstate New York in a town called Gilbertsville, and they had a repertoire company. And I was hired to teach the cast how to do improv. So I went up there for a couple of weeks. I taught the cast how to do improv during dinner. It was an Elizabethan dinner, believe it or not. And then I was going to come back after I did Play It Again, Sam, to be part of the repertory company. So I was in upstate New York. I did that for 2 weeks. I came down. I did Play It Again, Sam. And then I came back up to Gilbertsville, and the cast auditions for the various roles and the plays they do for the summer. And unbelievably, I got cast as Petruchio in Taming of the Shrew. So I went from doing Woody Allen to the lead, the romantic lead in a Shakespeare play in the same summer.
That's acting, and, Alice. That's acting.
Yeah. And I said, you know something? I got freaking talent.
Now, I don't want to put you on the spot, but do you have any Woody Allen in you?
Yeah, sure. Let me make sure I've got it right here. I'm unbelievable in bed. My honeymoon night, making love to my wife. She gets out of bed, gives me a standing ovation.
So that's really fascinating. So you were doing some acting that transferred into stand-up comedy. And then in the 80s, you kind of fell back on acting and ended up on a couple TV shows and you ended up doing, I believe, three movie spots. I don't know if
you know what? I don't want to overblow this. I did. I got bits in acting here and there. I got a small bit on a thing called Delta House. By the way, have you ever seen Marathon Man? About 5 minutes into the movie, I have no lines, but I get a close up when these two old guys, one is bashing the other guy's car, and I'm the witness, and I go, look at me, I got the whole screen. I didn't do too much acting per se. I think the biggest role I had is in On Wings of Eagles. It was a two-part television movie that starred Burt Lancaster and Richard Crenna.
Oh, right, Richard Crenna, right.
And believe it or not, Richard Crenna, who was about 6'3", played Ross Perot.
That's funny.
For those who don't know who Ross Perot is, he ran for president, third party. He was about 5'5". So Richard Crenna, this real tall guy, was playing Ross Perot, who nobody knew what he looked like in those days. And I got cast to play Henry Kissinger. But when they moved it to Mexico, that's where they shot the movie. They said, you know, if we only make it a telephone call instead of an in-person scene, we can save a lot of money. So I just did the voice on the phone of Henry Kissinger.
Oh, geez. So acting, yeah. But more voice acting at that point. Well, that's interesting. Right, you really touched on every aspect of show business from the 70s into the 80s. And then I know that it transitioned. I'm not sure what year, but you ended up becoming a television regular in the San Jose area, is that right, as the consumer guy?
Right. What happened was I decided, you know, it's time for me to move on. I set a limit. I said, if I'm not going to make it big as a comedian where I don't have to scrounge for jobs every week, I'm going to find another place to go. And I was always into consumer activism. Ralph Nader was my hero, and he still is. You know, a lot of people badmouth him. He had more influence on this country than most people know in terms of consumer activism. And I said, what if I became a television consumer reporter, but with a sense of humor? I don't know if you remember David Horowitz.
Right, right.
He used to have he had Fight Back. So what I did was I took out a second mortgage. I put together a team to videotape some scenes, not scenes, but reports that I actually wrote and did some research on. And I started sending them around. I sent them to 150 different TV stations. I got no response. And then what was then KHJ-TV, which I could see from my second story bedroom in L.A., that's how close I was to the studio, they had a morning show. And I sent it to them, and they had me on the show, and I showed one of my reports, and I talked about it. And then I used that tape, and I started sending that around, and I ended up with a regular gig in Fresno, first of all, at the ABC station in Fresno. I was a consumer reporter there. That was for 1 year when I made so much trouble with our advertisers because I was an effective consumer reporter. But they yanked away that franchise. I was no longer a consumer reporter, and I had to do the regular garbage that they do in local news. And after 4 years, I got the gig in San Jose, which is a great city. And I was a consumer reporter there. And then after 4 years, they offered me a contract. We got into a whole thing. They didn't want to pay me enough, but they wanted me to sign a 3-year contract. And I walked, and that was the single greatest mistake I've ever made in my life, because a year later, it became the NBC O&O station, meaning owned and operated station for the entire Bay Area.
Wow. But it's interesting. There's several things I could comment on in that story. And it's a great story of anybody that thinks getting into television is easy. First off, you had to four-wall your presentation, which means you paid for everything up front to create those initial tapes. Then you had to send them out to 150 stations and got no response. You got a shot on a morning show where you were able to share one of the things you four-walled, and that led to at least a 4 or 5 year career between Fresno and San Jose doing it. So it paid off, but it wasn't easy.
No, I left a big hunk out of the story. I almost forgot. Once I got that thing on that local show, in that morning show, I sent my tape, I can't believe I left this out, to the home show. It was a morning show starring Gary Collins on ABC. And they called me in and they said, okay, tell us what you would do. And I told them, they said, we're going to give you a shot on the show. So I became an irregular regular on the home show for about a year and a half. How did I leave that out? So I actually started on the network and I was on about once a month or so. And from that, I used that tape to get to Fresno. I don't know how I left that out. I started at the network. Then I went to Fresno. Then I went to a South Bay station. So I was basically trying to work my way down from the network and eventually end up in Guam.
Well, it's not the trajectory you were planning, but at least you were moving forward. It's interesting, just a quick correlation for my audience, because much earlier on, I did a podcast with Paul and Phil, which were two somewhat famous radio guys here in Sacramento. And while on the radio, they started the Answer Guys, and they ended up on the Discovery Channel with their own show. It ended up only being on for a few years, and then they had contract issues as well. But it was similar in that if you put together a package and it's good enough, people will find it, and it could lead to something. But there's a lot of time and a lot of investment ahead of that. And I think the backstory to what you're saying is you've touched all these different art forms, but you were really working hard in a lot of different directions to make a living. It doesn't sound like it was easy.
No, it wasn't easy. And, I'm a really lucky guy. I have a wife, my wife, Cheryl, who is just so supportive of almost anything I do. And that really helped. She said, yeah, go for it. So I took a chance. I don't know anybody else who ever got into TV news the way I did, but I said, what the hell? If you don't give it a shot, you'll always say, why didn't I?
Right, right. And as a serial entrepreneur, I've not said no to any crazy idea. And people that know me will, especially my wife, will agree to that. But it's interesting. It sounds like even comedy, you kind of came in through the back door. And with TV news, you came in through the back door. I mean, even the Woody Allen bit way back in New York on stage, it wasn't like you were a guy that came out of acting school and were showcasing all over the place. You kind of backdoored all these different things, sometimes through luck and sometimes to perseverance and four-walling your own program. I mean, it sounds so fascinating.
Well, thanks. I wouldn't say I got into comedy through the back door, because I just went and I auditioned, when I did that first audition, it was that bit that I wrote when I was waiting to get into that acting audition. I, wrote that whole thing in my head. And that was the way I knew. I mean, my friend said, why don't you try out at this club? And they had open mic on Mondays, and I tried out. But, the thing about show business is, I always tell people, the one rule about show business is, there are no rules in show business.
That's so true. There's no set path that you know, you could be an absolute loser. And if you get spotted in a certain cafe in the right day, the right time by the right person, you could end up getting the golden ticket and be a superstar. And there's other people that I know, and I'm sure you would agree, that have worked their whole lives, are tremendously talented, very professional, and, you know, barely scratched out a living. I mean, they made a living, but they weren't never famous. And yet they've been in the industry a long time. And I wanted to reiterate, when I said came in through the back door in comedy, it's been my experience, and I've written about in my books, and I've talked about on the podcast, that your average stand-up comic gets that open mic, works at it for 6 months, a year, 2 years, maybe they start emceeing or opening up. It's a process that takes time and energy and perseverance and hard work and comedy writing to achieve a certain level, to, especially if you want to be a headliner. You starting so early on in the 70s, I'm not saying it was an easier path, but there were so few professional clubs that being seen by Bud and being able to perform at the Improv in New York, you know, pretty early on, really kind of fast-tracked you. And I think part of that is it was a different system from the 80s and 90s, and it's totally different now. And also, there was such a limited amount of places that you could work compared to the 80s and 90s and now. I mean, I was just trying to break down chronologically how the industry has changed, and I think that you were able to utilize your talents at a unique time in stand-up comedy history.
Yeah, I guess so, because before the Improv, the only places to work in New York were the, you know, like the small clubs in the Village, where Lenny Bruce and Woody Allen and Joan Rivers, they started at places like the Gaslight, and I guess the Village Vanguard and the Village Gate, and, you know, whatever you could grab, and then hope you get the exposure to TV. One of the things that makes it much tougher to get that exposure on the big shows, there are so many comedians out there, you know, and it used to be there were a few places where the bookers could see you. So it made it that much easier for the limited number of comedians in those days. Now, you know, around the time I started making a living, I pretty much knew every other comic who was making a living. And now it's not that way at all. There were just so many people starting anywhere in the country. It used to be, it was either New York, Chicago, or LA, San Francisco.
Yeah, no, it definitely, like a lot of industries, I mean, we shouldn't be too shocked. It's been 40 years, 50 years that all this has transpired. But still, you know, if you're in opera or theater or an orchestra, earning the first chair or getting on stage as a lead actor is pretty much the same now as it was 20, 30, 40 years ago. But comedy as an art form has really changed and morphed over the decades. I just wanted to touch on that, because for me, it's interesting. I hope for my audience, it's interesting. But if you step back and were to look at a 50-year history of stand-up comedy per se, we're not talking comedy actors or funny films or TV shows. We're talking about stand-up comedy. It has so different from the 70s, and then it changed in the 80s and 90s, and then it changed in the 90s and 2000s. And now it's such a different thing that if you were to try to go out and reinvent yourself, you wouldn't recognize the stand-up world.
I think it's very true. I think the quality was better back then. It's easy for anybody to say, you know, when I was a comedian, things were much better. But there was more thought in it, more cleverness. I mean, not everybody, but generally, you know, generally speaking, I feel the same way about popular music now. I just feel like, you know, in the 70s and the 80s, the 60s, there was so much sophistication mixed in with the happy music. And now I hear very little of it in new music. And I sort of turn my back on it. I have no interest in rap. I go, to me, music has to have a melody. If it doesn't have a melody, it's just poetry, and then you add a beat to it, you know.
It's those guys that do the free talking with a little music behind them. It's not really orchestrated music that you can dance to.
Yeah, you know, sometimes I'll be sitting at a light, you know, with the windows open, and there's a guy in the car next to me, and he's got rap on, and I'm going, that's the same song that the last car had and the car last week had. It's just they changed the words. There's only three rap songs. That's it. And then they changed the words to the, and I can't call it a melody.
Yeah.
Now I sound like an old fart. I know it, but.
No, I think it's interesting. And just to keep with the correlation I was saying, music has changed over the decades, yet becoming a professional musician is still pretty much the same now as it was in the 70s. And you can't say that about comedy. But let's move on, because you are even more fascinating and have more talent. You've actually authored a couple books in the last couple decades. You put together Enough of Us is the first book you did, and that came out when?
That was the second book.
Oh, Enough of Us was the second book. Okay. The first book was on hiring contractors without going through hell.
That's right. I decided to write a contractor book because I thought maybe that would help me get a job on air. So I submitted a concept to various agencies. And one, just about the last one I could have reached, a woman and her husband in Connecticut who had a writer's agency, she said, okay, I'm going to shop this around and see what I can do. It was just a concept. And it was an all comprehensive book on hiring all kinds of, or on dealing with all kinds of consumer issues. She came back, she says, I have one publisher who's interested, but they want it on one particular subject. And they suggested maybe hiring contractors because everybody has trouble hiring contractors. As a matter of fact, I was just, as we're talking, I'm in the middle of settling a lawsuit with a contractor. So I said, okay, I'll give it a shot. And I did my research and I wrote the book and I put jokes in the book so it's not too heavy. And I made it a little tongue in cheek. And that publisher said, okay. And it was a small publisher in New York, though, Walker and Company. They've been absorbed by another company now. And that book stayed in print for 15 years. They did four printings of it. So,
wow.
And that came out just around the time I got my first newsroom job in Fresno. Yeah.
That's incredible. And then when did you and your wife collaborated on the second book, didn't you?
Right. And that one, I have to admit, is self-published. It was hard to find a publisher for it. But the name of the book is The name of the book is Enough of Us. And the subtitle is Why We Should Think Twice Before Making Children.
And sounds very pertinent.
It's a curious book. What's that?
It sounds very pertinent, people. There's a lot of great kids, but a lot of bad parents.
Well, this deals with all of the ramifications of having children. And the most common response, if I ask, you know, people say to me, how come you don't have kids? And I go, well, why would I have kids? Or I will say, well, why did you have kids? And then they'll say, and I phrase it this way, why did you want kids? And this is the response I most commonly get. Why do I want kids? Because they don't even know. Most people have kids because people have kids, and they don't even really give it any thought. I asked my own mother that once, and she said, I had kids because that's what was expected of people. You get married, you have kids. And we came from a lower middle class neighborhood, and in every apartment, there were two kids. Not one and not three. Everybody had two kids because that's all they could afford, and it's mostly one-bedroom apartments. So that was the expectation, and that's what they did. And we go through all the things that could go wrong, both societally and in terms of personal life. I had a miserable childhood. I mean, it was really bad. I was a very depressive kid, and my brother did worse than I did because my parents didn't have a clue. And I'm going, people just think they're going to have kids, and their kids are going to, you know, get a cure for the latest disease. So we said, think about this. And then if you decide you want to have kids, go right ahead, have kids. But give it some thought first. I mean, people don't realize.
Yeah, no. And how many?
One out of every 15 people in the United States spend some time in jail. How's that for a statistic?
Yeah, no. And how many kids are born because of the whole whoops? You know, they were yeah. so passionate they weren't thinking, and or as we used to say, thinking with the wrong head. But it is
exactly.
But you know, it's interesting because a lot of us strive to be parents, and it's not an easy gig. And we constantly see people that we're going, what were they thinking? And it is interesting that you wrote a book on it. Now, your two books, one's been in and out of publishing for 15 years. When did the second book come out?
Oh, that was in 2013 was Enough of Us.
And did you have some success with that?
Very little. We got some publicity. We even made it to the front page of the Sunday section of the San Jose Mercury News and all of its affiliated newspapers around the Bay Area.
Yeah, so besides TV and movies, you got your 15 minutes of fame on the front page of the Sunday section.
Right. So, with a very nice picture, by the way. And, you know, we did radio interviews, one television interview, that kind of thing. But it's amazing how little people want to read this. I find there's a certain resistance. Like, I don't want to read why I shouldn't have kids because I have kids. But some people, the interesting thing is we have some friends who had kids who read the book and were very positive about it. You know, they said, boy, you bring up great points here. You know, it's a serious book, but not too heavy-handed, and it's a subject that, in the age of environmentalism, in the age of climate change, that people don't think that the main basic cause of screwing up this planet is we have three times as many people on this planet than the planet can accommodate.
Yeah,
and
overpopulation.
Thinks, well, I'm going to have grandkids and they'll be fine. But no, they're their own worst enemy.
Well, I think everybody in podcast land, if you want an interesting book that talks about the pros and cons of mostly the cons of raising children and want to at least get you to think about it before you procreate, it's still out there. It's called Enough of Us, written by Ellis Levinson. And you've had such an incredible career. I know you're retired now, but you do have a lot of creative juices. What is it that's keeping you busy these days, Ellis?
My wife and I travel a lot, and we're finally going to get back on the road again this coming week. I don't know what date people will be listening this to on, but we're going to be going to New York for 2 weeks. We're doing a road trip around the state and then a week in the city. So I'm going home and I'm seeing my homies.
Oh, that sounds like fun.
And we've been very fortunate. We've traveled all over the world. And what I was hoping to do this coming winter was go to Antarctica, but we missed the boat, literally and figuratively. So that's going to be next year. And I will have gotten to every continent. And so we've been very, very fortunate that way. And if you have the wherewithal to travel around the world, and I mean, people are afraid to go to places like India. They say, I don't want to see all that poverty. And I go, it's so enriching. And it makes you, it expands who you are as a person. And the great thing for me is in the more exotic places, we tend to travel on group tours, in which case I become the class clown, which I always enjoy anyway. So that's a nice sign.
Well, as we finish up this interview, Ellis, it's just been tremendous to reconnect with you. And I had no idea what a deep and rich heritage you have in show business. And you really have touched so many types of art forms, you know, the different vehicles, television, author, movies, stand-up comedy on stage, plays. I mean, you've really run the gamut. I know you as a stand-up comic. I appreciated your comedy and you working for me at Laughs Unlimited. So for that, let me say thank you for your part of my house, the house that comedy built. I appreciate you doing this podcast, and I just think it's great that we've had a chance to catch up. Thank you so much for sharing your amazing story.
Oh, I have one quick compliment to add to you. When people say to me, where can I find some of your old stand-up comedy? I have a thing on where I can give people my password. They go to Google Pictures or Google Photo, whatever it is. And the one set I have up there is a 1983 set at Laughs Unlimited. And it's a 45-minute set. So people are still watching me at Laughs Unlimited of all places.
Oh, well, that's great. Well, we'll appreciate that you did that and the fact that you're keeping it alive out there. Thanks so much, Ellis, for everything and for doing this podcast. And we'll be hoping and crossing our fingers you make it to Antarctica soon.
Okay, thanks. And it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me.
All right. Everybody, ladies and gentlemen, stay tuned. I actually have a little stand-up comedy by Ellis Levinson, and we appreciate Ellis and you guys listening, and we'll be back with some comedy in just a minute, and then next week with another great show. All right, here we go, some great stand-up comedy by Ellis Levinson. Hey, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to interrupt the show briefly to share some information. First off, this next set was recorded live on stage in 1983, and the volume is really low. So be sure to turn up the volume and enjoy just a few minutes of Ellis Levinson live on stage. Also, a quick historical note, this was before the ban of smoking inside businesses. So there's an interesting part where he's interacting with the smoker, and I just thought that might be fun in this day and age to hear what it was like in 1983 in a nightclub. Okay, turn up the volume. Here's a quick set by Ellis Levinson. Here we go.
He's a regular on Wayland Flowers at Madam's Place as well, okay? Now, ladies and gentlemen, this is his fifth time here at Laughs Unlimited. I know you're going to enjoy his humour and his comedy. Put your hands together. Nice warm welcome for Mr. Ellis Levinson. Enemas. Has anybody heard of this? Right? You've heard of this, right? I'm not making this up. It's for real. What worries me about this, though, if this catches on, coffee enemas, what's going to happen to coffee commercials? You know, John never wants a second bag of my coffee. There's John sitting there getting really ticked off.
That's because you don't use human!
Hey, calm down, John. Let's just put some sank up your ass. Humanistic side of something, but how does Stevie Wonder know that his friends aren't dressing him up to look like an idiot? He's got to trust these people. I mean, how does he know there isn't some guy who's working for him who's thinking, God damn, that dumbbell makes $1 million a month and pays me $100 a week. I'm going to dress him up to look like Ronald McDonald. Worries me. How far up his head does Kelly Savalas wash his face? He could reach his ass before he quits. I'll tell you what else worries me. What the hell is spam? Does anybody know what that stuff in the can actually is? We don't know what's in there. I mean, I'm telling you folks, there's no animal out there called spam.
Maybe a lot of money. What do you say we kill that old spam and eat that sucker, huh?
Now, obviously, the am part of the word spam is ham. What I want to know is what the hell this is. Are we talking about spit and ham here? I mean, I don't know what body parts it is, but if this is sperm and ham, I don't want to know about it. A little more smoke, please. Cancer is my hobby. Okay? The Air Force couldn't take off in this, you know what I'm saying? But I got an answer for you. You're no fool. You smoke marriage because you want to live 3 weeks longer than your friends. The warning on the
the pack, the warning on the pack doesn't bother you, huh? I mean, the Surgeon General went through all of this trouble, and I wish I felt that this thing had an effect on America, did something. But you think, like, ever, like, one time in the history of the universe, somebody has ever picked up a pack of cigarettes and said, you know, I think I'm going to have me a smoke, and... Holy smoke, there's a warning on this thing. The Surgeon General has determined that...
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Stand Up Comedy, Your Host and MC. For information on the show, merchandise, and our sponsors, or to send comments to Scott, visit our website at www.standupyourhostandmc.com. Look for more episodes soon and enjoy the world of stand-up comedy. Visit a comedy showroom near you.